Daniel chapter 30 follows. Oh, the kids need to leave. I'm sorry. Kids need to. Where's Clady? Clady's up there probably going, where is everybody? Oh, Luis just came down to look. So there we go. Yes, there we go. Yes, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. We only got a couple. Yeah, I tell you, when the Mannings and the Metcalfs aren't here, it can be a little bit sparse up there. But that's okay. We're all good. 1 Samuel chapter 30. This is obviously following chapter 29, and remember the story, even though you all disagree with me, you're all wrong. However you slice it, that's okay, Garrett. I'm not going to fight you anymore on this. However you slice it, David has just been kicked out of the Philistine army, which, of course, it was going to be problematic anyway, marching into battle against your own people, and if he had a grand scheme to ambush the Philistines, whatever the case may be, David has been sent back. He has been told, you need to go back home. You are not allowed to march with us. Now, I want you to imagine, because it's going to talk about how long they've been going. It is about a 75-mile journey that they have been on. So they have been marching, and I don't know how fast the army has been marching, but they've been marching 75 miles from Ziklag to the battle front. And once they, so it could have taken them 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 days. I mean, 10 miles in a day is pretty hefty itself. They've gone there, and then they've been told, right before they're going to go into battle, we don't want them there. So then they have to, as it says in verse 1, they reached Ziklag on the third day. So they marched 75 miles in 3 days. That's a pretty big speed. 25 miles in a day. They're hoofing it to get back to Ziklag. Now, they're all excited. They're excited to get home, get a shower, have some home-cooked food. They haven't seen their wife and their kids for about a week, maybe longer, and they're ready to just get home. They're excited that God worked everything out. They're going to be back in their hometown and wondering what's going to happen next. The problem is their town has been destroyed. So on the third day, they arrived. Now, the Amalekites had raided the Negev and Ziklag. They attacked Ziklag and burned it, and had taken captive the women and all who were in it, both young and old. They killed none of them, but carried them off as they went on their way. I tried to figure out what would be worse. Would it have been horrible to come back to Ziklag and find everyone dead and the city burned, or come back to Ziklag and find the city burned, but no one dead? Which one's worse? Because as you start to think about it, there's only one reason to capture all the women and the children. They're going to turn them into slaves. And we're not talking working out on the plantation slaves. We're talking other things will be happening to them that I shouldn't be talked about. And this is going to be really, really brutal. And worse than that, if whoever captured them gets back to their home base, eventually then they might even then just be sold to all parts of the world for whatever that person wants to do with women and with children. You getting my drift here? So I really had a struggle with which one was worse. Because you can imagine coming home, they've just marched 75 miles, they're in town, they're exhausted, and as they get there, the place is leveled. There is not a dead body anywhere, so they know that everyone's alive, but now they're in trouble because what do you do? Immediately we would say, you know, call the police, get some helicopters and some dogs on the case, and go find them out. The problem is they have absolutely no idea who did it. They have no idea when they did it because they've been gone for over a week, or at least a week, maybe more. How much of a head start do they have? What direction do we go? That way? That way? We have no idea even where to head. And if the further they get, the more chances are that we will never, ever, ever, ever see those people ever again. So you got to imagine that right now this is probably one of the top 10 most depressing moments in all of the Bible. Everyone's gone. What do you do? Verse 3. When David and his men came to Ziklag, they found it destroyed by fire and their wives and sons and daughters taken captive. So David and his men wept aloud until they had no strength left to weep. And I think we've all been in those situations where you weep so heavily that you literally have no strength left in you. This is, again, the same reason why the disciples fell asleep in the Garden of Gethsemane. Normally we like to hammer them. You know, here's Jesus praying and being all noble, and here are these slacker disciples tired because they've had a long day and they're sleeping while Jesus is saying, please stay awake. And we forget that the text specifically says that they had been weeping so heavily because they knew Jesus was going to die. They figured that part out. And so they were exhausted, physically and emotionally exhausted from all their weeping, and that is what's happened now with David and his men. Because as you know, at this point, there is no hope. Well, it's not entirely true, is it? Because it is true no matter how dark, how desperate, how crazy, how bad, as we sang, the road marked with suffering is, there is still someone who knows and sees everything. And that's God. But the sad part is, for three chapters, we haven't heard God's name. I don't think God's around. David has not seen fit to inquire of him. And so this is where kind of the faith rubber hits the road. Saul gets into a desperate situation and he goes to a witch, goes to a spiritual medium to try and do anything it is to get some spiritual direction. And now all I have to do is sit here and think, I sure hope and I sure pray that David figures this one out. Is he going to turn inward? Is he just going to give up? Is he going to pursue other unspiritual means to find God's direction for his life? Or is he going to do something that is absolutely contrary to human nature, and that is actually seek God's face in the midst of bad times? I don't care what you say. When you're a strong Christian, when things are great in your life, and we talk about bad times, you would say, you bet. When the bad times hit, I'm going to go seek God. When things are looking bleak and desperate, I'm going to go straight to God. I'm going to be in prayer more often. I'm going to go to church more often. I'm going to read the scriptures more often. I don't care how strong you are. For some reason, it is wired in our DNA that when bad times hit, the first thing we do is jettison God. It happens. So you're not a slacker. You're not weird. You're not a loser of a Christian if you do that, because everyone does it. I've done it. I know families. I still think, I have one family that's the perfect example. They come to church and they're so excited. They're like, oh, church, this is where I belong. I know people there. I get strengthened. I am able to worship and learn, and I grow and I derive comfort from being amongst God's people. And then I can guarantee with this particular family, give it 2 weeks, 3 weeks maximum, and something bad will happen to that family and I will not see them for 3 months. Because I don't know what it is. That is what we do. That is how we act. And that's the curious thing about David, because when things got bad for him, David ran. Now there is no hope. What will David do? Verse 5. David is not immune to this because, as you know, he had two wives in that town. I am not going to get into a discussion of polygamy. That'll be for a whole nother topic. David's two wives had been captured, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. Do you think it could get any worse for David? Could it possibly get any worse? Of course it can, because as they say, it's always darkest right before it goes pitch black. Just like the disciples, as they've been out on the ocean or out on the Sea of Galilee and they've been rowing their boat and the place is getting tossed and turned and Jesus isn't anywhere to be found because he's up on a mountainside praying. How silly is that? And then they pray and all of a sudden he shows up and calms the sea and everything looks like it's going to be great. And then they beach their thing and you're thinking like, oh, it can't get any worse, right? We've been saved. Now everything's going to be great and rosy and dandy. And all of a sudden they're met by a naked, crazy man possessed by 2,000 demons. And that's how we sometimes get. You know, bad things happen and then it stops and we think to ourselves, that's it. Finally, I can have some relief. And the next thing you know, another bad thing happens. And that's what happens here with David, because verse 6, David was greatly distressed because the men were talking of stoning him. Each one was bitter in spirit because of his sons and daughters. So he's come back. The whole place is burned. He's probably tired, has a few blisters, wants a nice hot shower and a home-cooked meal. Everything is gone. His wife, his children, all of the stuff is gone. And now the men are turning on him and saying, let's kill the leader. Because that's what we do when bad things happen. Kill the leader. I mean, it's just a natural thing. So David is now probably at one of his biggest lows of his life. It's okay. It gets worse for David in 2 Samuel, just so you know. So no matter how bad it gets, it can always get worse. Isn't this a great uplifting message? This is, you're like, oh, I feel so much better now. I'm sorry. But there is some actually really cool stuff in here, because look at the last half of verse 6. But David found strength in the Lord his God. Not the best translation. I'll give you a better one. But David strengthened himself in the Lord. Most of the times when we talk about finding strength, when it's reflexive like that, it's usually in a military sense. People strengthen their armies. But in fact, this does show up a couple of times in Scripture. This same concept, Job chapter 4, verses 3 and 4. Think how you have instructed many, how you have strengthened feeble hands. This is talking about what God does for us. Does God really care when things are bad in your life? Absolutely. Though you may not believe it when you're good. The best part is make the decision now. Make the conscious choice now. Because when you're going through it, it doesn't seem all that good, does it? We cry out like David, where he says, it feels like wave after wave is just sweeping over me. It feels like you've put me in a pit and abandoned me. That's what it feels like, but that's not what what the Bible says. How you've strengthened feeble hands. Your words have supported those who have stumbled. You have strengthened faltering knees. Do I have another one? Or is that the whole 3 and 4? That's all 3 and 4. Same concept then shows up in 2 Chronicles. I should have that. No? Oh, sweet Moses. Oh, it's because it's a whole chapter. Oh my gosh, that's right. Sorry. 2 Chronicles, flip there. 2 Chronicles chapter 27. I flip forward, yeah, sorry. 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles. 2 Chronicles 27. The whole chapter is a great chapter, but I'm going to focus mainly. We'll just read verse 6. 2 Chronicles 27, verse 6. Should we have a woman read it? Oh, sorry, that's just me. Jotham grew powerful because he walked steadfastly before the Lord his God. When things are bad, when things are dark, when things are desperate, strengthen yourself in the Lord. How do I strengthen myself in the Lord? Walk steadfastly before him. I'm telling you, this is not easy. I've had to do this a couple of times. It is not easy. You normally have to have sane people around you at that time to help you through your desperate times, to remind you, Mark, it's all okay. Mark, we're going to get through this. Mark, God is still in control. Mark, there is still a plan. And I've had to have that happen, as I've had to stand by many of you and say, it's okay. God is still in control. God still has a plan, which is why it is so important that you don't abandon church or God or fellowship or friendship during the hard times. Finding strength in God. You know, it's been a drought with 3 chapters of no God talk. Now we got God there. Praise God. Yes.
Pretty hard to walk steadfastly when you're in a fetal position.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's some of the most toughest stuff to ever have to do. To continue to do that which you know is the best for you, when you feel so immobilized and helpless and paralyzed on the ground. Yeah. Which is why I tell you, Ecclesiastes is so true. Pity the man who falls and has no one around. Which is why church is so crucial. Without the people around to say, to get down on the ground with you while you're in the fetal position and say, This too will pass. God is still in control, even though you can't feel it and you don't know it. Yeah. Yeah, well, it's always, I'm telling you, that whole Lord's Prayer, easy prayer, right? Yeah. Let your will be done. Yeah, do you like that one? I hate that one personally, because I personally would rather be in control. Lord, let my will be done on earth as it should be done there in heaven, because I know a whole lot better than you. But when we actually stop and say, Lord, let your will be done, watch out. Same thing. I know I won't make you do it, but that time when we prayed for bad things to happen to us, yeah, I know, I totally ruined your guys' lives, you know? Yeah, thanks. But I didn't do it, it was God. But through that, I've been amazed, because I know I went through some very dark and desperate times, and God saw me through. I know God has had very terrible things happen to a lot of people, and yet we've gotten through it. How? With each other, through study, through just staying steadfast in God. How crucial that is. So David found strength in the Lord. But there is no hope, right? There can be a time when, in this world, when things are so bad that there is no hope, right? No, there's always God. He is our trump card. He is the thing we pull out when all else fails. Because God, strangely, still in control. Then David said to Abiathar the priest, yes, Saul is going and consulting a witch. David is consulting a priest. Saul is going into a cave that is dark and dank and smells of evil. And David is going and seeking the truth and God's will and light for his life. Incredible. Finally, and I'm sure, I don't know, was Abiathar, I always wonder, when David is doing things and not consulting God, what does Abiathar do then at that point? I mean, do you say anything? Like, David, hey, you know, because I don't know about you, I get really annoyed when we're getting ready to make an important decision, and then some stupid board of directors says, you know what? We should pray. And I'm like, oh, come on. Pray at a time like that. You know, yeah. And then I'm always reminded I'm just an idiot. I always loved it when I served at another church. There was this, she was the secretary, and she bugged the crud out of all the leaders because she would do that for everything. Oh, really? We're going to add a new worship service? We should pray. And they're like, but why? Let's just make the decision. And so I wonder, is Abiathar like a thorn in their flesh? Because that's a good thing. Hopefully I'm reminding you, and please, I am not perfect. You should be harassing me on a semi-daily basis, maybe weekly. Are we praying? Are we seeking God's will? What are we doing about that? What does God say about that? Because I tell you, it's easy to jettison it. It's easy to forget. So David goes to Abiathar the priest, and he says, bring me the ephod! Yay! Abiathar had to dust it off. It, you know, hadn't been used in a while. Abiathar brought it to him, and David inquired of the Lord, shall I pursue this raiding party? Will I overtake them? Because that's the question. Can I get the stuff back? Does God want to have the stuff come back? Is God punishing me because I have been living for a year outside of His will? I've been doing things that I shouldn't, living a double life, not inquiring of the Lord. Is this punishment for it? And so that's a great question, and the answer is, pursue them. You will certainly overtake them and succeed in the rescue. Wow. Could you believe that promise? It's a great promise, but you still got to imagine. You got 600 guys, a bunch of them want to kill you because they hate your guts. Everyone's gone. You just have been walking for 7-8 straight days with equipment, and now you've got to go pursue, and pursue means you've got to go faster than them to overtake them. How far away are they? If you were one of David's men, would you have believed the promise? I mean, David, could you imagine that as a little staff meeting? All right, we got around. We're going to go after them. Immediately, someone's going to say, wait, which way? How far away are they? Have they killed anybody yet? Are we even going to succeed? Oh, God said we're going to succeed. Oh, really? God said it, huh?
You think like a male and a husband. You said several times, God get the stuff.
Yes. Yes, go get the, sorry, yes. Go get the women, go get your wife, your beloved, beautiful, gorgeous wife, and your wonderful children that just bless your heart daily. Yes, and all your stuff. Because remember, the big screen TV has been taken, the Wii is gone, they took it all, including your wife and your children, which are vastly more important than any stuff. Is that right? Mike, you got my back? They didn't take the Wii set, are you sure? Oh, the weight set. It's a lot of weight, yes. And the sheep and the cattle and all that stuff, yes. Yeah, and this is, again, if something happened to my wife and children, I would need therapy for a long time, and I would need people around. I mean, it's, yeah, when you lose that, that's the worst. It's the worst, yeah. David is going to go and pursue. Pursue, you will succeed. Verse 9, David and the, so as he did, somehow or other, the 600 men said, yes, let's go, let's overtake them. So David and the 600 men with him came to the Besor ravine, where some stayed behind, for 200 men were too exhausted to cross the ravine. But David and 400 men continued the pursuit. Let's just ask the question now before we get to the text that actually addresses it. Because you could probably imagine, since God did say, pursue them, you will overtake them and gain everything back. Do you think that will happen? Yeah, I mean, just on a base, I mean, it's simple, but even before you get to the text, you could probably imagine they're going to win. Now, so imagine you're David with the 400 men, and 200 guys are too tired. Some of them got some cramps, someone's got an ingrown toenail, and they just can't make the hike any further. What would you be thinking about those people? Wimps. What's wrong with you? Like, and then you've only got 600 men. You're now going to cut the force a third. That's a lot of people to now no longer go. How would you be feeling about those 200 men? Yeah. Can you imagine? Because you know they're going to win, and the wife is going to be like, honey, you know? Yeah, he was too tired to make the trip. He's not here right now. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah, he was the single guys that are like, I'm tired. I got no dog in this fight, you know. I got no women to, you know, pursue. Oh, yeah, or their marriages were a little rocky going, yeah, is it really worth it? Do you have to recover the mother-in-laws, too? Yeah. So off they go. Now they only have 400 because 200 could not. And again, I do have to empathize. 200 men are completely exhausted because they have been traveling a lot. A lot. Verse 11. They found an Egyptian in a field and brought him to David. What? An Egyptian in a field. Do they not have better things to do? They find some poor Egyptian. They gave him water to drink and food to eat, part of a cake of pressed figs, so those are fig newtons, and 2 scoops of raisins. Two cakes of raisins. He ate and was revived, for he had not eaten any food or drunk any water for 3 days and 3 nights. And you say, why? Aren't they on a mission from God? Why are you stopping to help this guy? And all of a sudden you start getting some overtones of the Good Samaritan. Because remember the two people that passed by, said dude that was half dead on the side of the road? They were very important people. They were people that had things to do. They were going somewhere. One of them a priest, one of them a teacher of the law. They had services to conduct. They had sheep to feed. They had voters meetings to attend. They could not stop and help someone because there were so many other people counting on. And you look at this and you're like, this is, at face value, you read it and you're just almost struck by the strangeness of there was an Egyptian and so they stopped to help him. Partially motivated, I'm certain, of the need to find reliable witnesses for the location of the women and the children and the stuff that was unimportant. But also, I could find myself in a situation like that going, the dude's half dead. We're wasting time. We should be moving on. And lo and behold, check out what happens. David asked him, to whom do you belong and where do you come from? He said, I am an Egyptian the slave of an Amalekite. Oh, and I should have said this earlier. I wouldn't have been surprised if David probably used that thing between his ears to figure out who possibly could have done this. Because remember, there'd been a long-standing fight amongst the Amalekites. The Amalekites had a really specific MO. The Amalekites fought in a very specific way. The biggest way was when the Israelites were crossing the desert and going to the promised land, the Amalekites would go with them and stay on the fringes. And what would happen is someone would have to use the bathroom. And when that person was alone, boom, swoop in, kill him. The old people who couldn't walk very fast, boom, swoop in, kill him. People that had some diseases and got sick along the way, boom, swoop in, take them. The Amalekites never once engaged them in a battle by themselves. They always wanted to pick off the weak and the ones that could not defend themselves. Yeah, and he's been hitting the Amalekites. Yeah. And the Adicites. Yeah. Yeah, they were. And the Cellulites and the. Yeah. Yeah. And the Amalekites had the MO of wait until all the men are gone. Here is a city that is now completely undefended. Come in and take all the women and the children. That sounds like an Amalekite to me. Which is why God was quite upset at the Amalekites because of what they did. So I think that, yes, if they come to find someone that was an Amalekite, maybe this is it. And the Egyptian says, I'm the slave of an Amalekite. What great luck. Isn't that fantastic? What would happen if they would have just left? What would happen if they said, he's just some Egyptian, probably doesn't know anything. He's the wrong ethnicity for an Amalekite. Maybe we should just not help at all. And that's when you realize that sometimes in the midst of all of our very important missions, maybe we should stop, like the Good Samaritan, and help people along the way. Maybe Hebrews is right, that sometimes we need to be careful that we show hospitality and love towards others because we just might entertain an angel. And I believe that's figurative and literal, because here's an opportunity when they could have just marched right on by and never said anything. When we were back at the St. Mark's facility, there was a time I remember, in preaching I get to look around and kind of see who's here and see who's not here, and I kind of, you know, do a little catalog in my mind. I remember one time I'd see there was this lady, and she always sat in the back, left, near the back pew, but always a little bit in, and she always came in a little late, and she always left a little early. And I would see this woman by herself do this over and over and over again. And I try to be fast enough, but sometimes I'm not fast enough to get to people. And my wife couldn't get to her either, and none of you guys could. Hopefully someone shook her hand and said hello. But finally, there was a Sunday where she came a little bit early to church. And I had seen her, so I ran up to her. I'm like, hey, how's it going? She goes, it's not going good. She says, my marriage is about to end. I lost my job. I have no money. I have a lot of health problems. And I go, well, I said, I could do counseling. I mean, I can help. You know, would your husband want to do some counseling? Yeah, we're thinking about it. I would really like to hope that would work. And she goes, do you really care? And I go, yeah. I mean, I know this is a horrible time. Can we pray? Let's pray for you right now. I know I grabbed a couple other people. Whoever was standing near me, I grabbed them. Whoever's in the back said, we got to pray and pray for this lady. And afterwards, she came to one of the counseling sessions. And she said, thank you so much. I go, why is that? She says, well, everything was so much in the toilet, and I had heard that maybe God cares, but I wasn't too sure, so I checked out your church, and if that didn't work, I was just going to kill myself that night. I'm really glad we said hello. I'm really glad we said hi. Are we sometimes in such a rush to go and do all these other things that here's this Egyptian by the field that maybe possibly was put there. I'm not doubting that God somehow orchestrated everything so that that person was there. And was David going to stop or just simply say, I'm on a mission and I got to keep going? And I think that's for us as well. Yeah. I've told you the story of the driving by the girl that needed help on the side of the road because her car broke down, and I was on my way to seminary and I was going to be late. So I just kept on going. And then my car broke down. You know, that's great when God punishes you immediately. It's like, okay, got the message, you know. I tried to think she was some weird psycho killer, but, you know, she was in a high school swatch plaid Catholic girl. I mean, she wasn't going to kill me. Oh, man. That's how all horror movies start, yes. Then she whips out a chainsaw. Yeah. That's what I tried to tell myself, but I'm not kidding. I'm driving along. I'm like, oh, I feel bad for her. And it was raining too, right? Oh, it's a bummer. I am not a good person. I just want to let you know. Yeah, I'm going to be driving along. Look, there's someone on the side of the road. I got to get back to the camp. Do we stop and help? I mean, this is incredible. So anyway. The Egyptian, I'm a slave in Amalekite. My master abandoned me when I became ill 3 days ago, and we raided the Negev of the Kerethites and the territory belonging to Judah and the Negev of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag. Oh. And at that point, I don't know what I would have done. You burned Ziklag? Yeah, because he didn't say they. He said, we. Ah. Yeah, and I also, maybe, you know, you think, because he's an Egyptian, he's a slave, I highly doubt he was, like, the big instrument of doom, but at the same time, could I think clearly at that point? Because, like Lynn, I am thinking about my wife, and I'm thinking about my children, and that antique vase that Grandma left me, and my big screen TV that they took. Yes, and we do know this. So David is looking for information, and he knows at this point this was totally providential. And I'm sure someone probably at that point said, I'm really glad we stopped. Isn't that a good thing? Sometimes it's good to say that. I'm glad we stopped and asked and helped. Because in however you slice this, this was very generous for them to stop and feed him the Fig Newtons and the two scoops of raisins. Yeah. Yeah. And we need to speak to a motivation of love instead of what can you do for me or what, you know, can I get out of you? Can you actually serve someone without any ulterior motive? And that seems to be the MO of Christ. He served us to bring us back. It didn't help. I mean, it didn't help him. I mean, Jesus is not like more blessed because he died and suffered. It was horrific and horrendous, but he did it solely out of care and concern for others, i.e. you and me. Yeah. So David asked him, can you lead me down to this raiding party? So they took him to Oakland. Yeah, that would be easy. That was one of those God moments. I didn't think of that joke before or right now. So that's a God's joke. Yeah. If you don't like it. If you liked it, I came up with that all in mind. He answered, swear to me before God that you'll not kill me or hand me over to my master and I'll take you down to him. Obviously, this guy doesn't want to die, so he's like, please don't kill me and don't give me back to them since I betrayed them. So he led David down and there they were scattered over the countryside eating, drinking, and reveling. See, it's dangerous to eat, drink, and revel. You never know what bad things lurk in the shadows. Because of the great amount of plunder they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from Judah. David fought them from dusk until the evening of the next day, which may not be entirely true. The word for dusk means a darker part of the day. And there's two dark parts of the day. One of them is dusk and the other one is dawn, right when you're getting up. So it very well could be. It's one or the other. A lot of commentators make a big deal. I don't see why. They either found them and said, let's go, or they found them and said, we need to take a wee bit of a nappy poo. And also it might even make sense if they're drinking and reveling all night in the morning. Yeah, they don't have any tomato juice. So they're going to be in a little bit of trouble. Yeah, they might be feeling a little bit yucky. So either way, they attack until evening the next day and none of them got away except 400 young men who made off on camels and fled. Which, how many men did David have? And they were able to take over a party that had a lot more than that because 400 escaped. I guess whoever was not drinking as much the night before was like, camel, and jumps on, and off they go. And here is what is really cool. David recovered everything the Amalekites had taken, including his two wives. Nothing was missing, young or old, boy or girl, plunder or anything else they had taken. David brought everything back. He took all the flocks and the herds, and his men drove them ahead of the other livestock, saying, "This is David's plunder." And that is a really cool concept. In the book of Joel, there is a prophecy that the people of God had not been following God's commands, and so there was going to be some bad times ahead. And in Joel chapter 1, verse 4, it talks about how what the locust swarm has left, the great locusts have eaten. What the great locusts have left, the young locusts have eaten. What the young locusts have left, other locusts have eaten. In other words, oh wait, don't go forward yet, go back. In other words, the locusts are coming and going to eat everything. They're going to take it all. And then, not a chapter later, Joel chapter 2, "I will repay you for the years the locusts have eaten, the great locusts and the young locusts, the other locusts and the locust swarm, my great army that I sent among you." That there is a promise that God restores. Now the cool part of it is David was able to find that restoration here on earth. And I think that's something we probably don't pray for a whole lot, because I just don't think it sounds awfully selfish. "Lord, so much has been taken from me. Lord, please restore unto me that which has been taken, that which has been lost." It seems a little weird for us to say it, but there's precedent that here David has recovered. He didn't lose a thing. He didn't lose one thing at all. What's also really neat about this is that ultimately all this gets restored future anyway. And I know this because of the book of Job. Don't go forward yet. The book of Job has some really interesting things, because there's something strange that happens in the book of Job. Because Job loses everything at the beginning. Job loses his kids, his camels, his sheep, his donkeys. He loses everything.
Except his wife.
Except his wife. Stuck along to say, "Curse God and die. Curse God and die. Curse God and die." And finally he sends her away, or she left. But what's really interesting is that at the end of the book, it says God restored everything to him double. He got double sheep, double camels, double doubles. He got everything back. But there's something weird, because he had seven kids, and at the end he gets set. That's not double. Well, yeah, it is, because he never lost the other seven. Because there will come a day when he'll be reunited with those seven and have seven more. So even when you lose, be it mom or dad or kid or husband or wife, there will come a day when that's restored, because God restores all things. Sometimes here on earth, and we're very thankful when it happens. And this is the other point to it, that God doesn't lose. Do you want to know one of my biggest fears? And it's an irrational fear. I understand that. And theologically, I can answer my own question, so don't answer my own question. But I sometimes wonder, how many people are living on this earth right now? 6 billion? How many have been before us? Billions and billions. How many are going to come after us? Billions and billions. And I think to myself, that's a lot of people. And I say to myself, can I slip through the crack? Going to get up to heaven? Hi! Mark Manning. Mark Manning, Mark Manning, Mark Manning. There's a lot of Mark Mannings. Orange County. Okay, that narrows it down. Lived in Orange. Okay. Pastored Searchlight Ministries. Rebel. Okay. Yes, go into the rebel file. No, don't got you. Sorry. Do you ever think that maybe God could lose you? There are lots of people. Or then we may not think that he'll lose us, but we do think stuff like this. "Dear Lord, please keep me safe as I travel back to the campground." And I sometimes think, you know what? Is God up there going, man, there's starving kids in Africa, and there's tsunamis that are happening in the east, and oil spills in the south, and there's problems all over the world, and you want me to keep you safe on a car trip? Are you kidding me? This is one of my things, and I think to myself, will God remember me? There's a lot of people in the world. Will God remember me? He remembers everything about us. And check these passages out. Same concept. "And this is the will of him who sent me, that I shall lose none of all that he has given to me, but rise them up." How many is he going to lose? You're not going to get up there and go, "Oh man, I tried. I was trying to, I was home many people I was trying to take care of." Wouldn't that make sense? an acceptable casualty loss in God's economy. I mean, you know, lose a couple here or there. I mean, there's billions. But not in God's economy. He won't lose anybody. And this actually got fulfilled in God's own time later on, John 18, when he actually allows the disciples to escape in the Garden of Gethsemane because the soldiers were there and wanted to kill him, especially knucklehead Peter with his wild swinging sword. Fisherman wielding a sword? Yeah, it's not going to be pretty. And they all left because this happened so the words he had spoken will be fulfilled. I have not lost one of those you gave me. God is in the restoration business. Sometimes we are blessed to have that restoration happen here and now. Look forward to the time that everything gets restored in heaven. All right, so what about those 200 men that were left behind? So I'm sorry, so just, no, don't read. What would you do? WWYD, what would you do in this situation? You've just fought all these guys, recovered everything, and you're coming back to the 200 lazy slacker bums. What would you do? That's exactly what they say. It's absolutely hilarious. They're like, okay, buddy, here's your wife, here's your kids, flat TV screen, that's mine. I'm keeping that because I fought. You didn't. You stay behind. What, was that unacceptable? I think that's, I mean, that seems wholly acceptable to me. Give them the wife and kids and say, on your way. Well, that's what they did. Look at this. Then David came to the 200 men who had been too exhausted to follow him and who were left behind at the Besor Ravine. They came out to meet David and the people with them. As David and his men approached, he greeted them. That's good news, right? That at least the leader's coming and saying, hey, buddy, how you doing, right? Oh, shoot. There we go. But all the evil men and troublemakers among David's followers said, remember that David is not leading like the most noble people in the world. These were the tax evaders, the thieves, the people that were hunted by the government. These were not always nice men. And all these troublemakers said, because they did not go out with us, we will not share with them the plunder we recovered. However, each man may take his wife and children and go. So there you go. Here's your wife. Here's your kids. I keep the we. Yeah. David replied, no, my brothers. You must not do that with what the Lord has given us. Wait a second. Oh, that's a big one. Wait. I thought this was my stuff. Oh, that's right. I only have my stuff because God gave me my stuff. It's really not my stuff. Whose plunder was it? Because they were marching out saying, this is David's plunder. This is David's plunder. And David is thinking the whole time, this is God's plunder. God allowed it. I mean, we were going to give up. We inquired. I think there might have been a chance that, you know, consulting the Urim and the Thummim, that they, you know, pointed in the right direction. God brought us here. It's not mine. This is God's. So this is what the Lord has given. He protected us and handed over to us the forces that came against us. This was all God's doing, not mine. Who will listen to what you will say? The share of the man who stayed with the supplies is to be the same as that who went down to the battle. All will share alike. David made this a statute and an ordinance for Israel from that day to this, which is a beautiful passage that Paul picks up later on in 1 Corinthians chapter 12. Starting in verse 12 and following, where an eye cannot look at a foot and say, I don't need you. And the foot can't look at the Yavula and say, what are you there for? That it doesn't matter who does what, it's all important. As I joked, some people think that the pastor is the most important person at church. And we all know that it's not me, but it's Bob. Bob is the most important person. No. But they sometimes say, and I think to myself, if I died tomorrow, would Searchlight continue? But would Searchlight, does the church still exist? Is Searchlight Ministries Mark Manning? No. Now, what would happen if all of you died? The church is gone then at that point because I ain't the church. I would come here, hello, welcome. No one's here. They're all gone. The church is you guys. You're the most important people. Which reminded me as I'm preparing for this, and I haven't asked the Rosses, but they'll let us come over anyway. We need to have another appreciation time. There we go. And he's going to make those hot dogs and cut them the way he did the last time with seasonings on them. Oh, I love it. Because I tell you, I just talked with someone the other day, and they're like, what's your volunteer rate at Searchlight? I said, 95%. And they're like, you're a liar. No church has 95% volunteer rate. And I looked through, and I've told this story before. There was one time I went ahead and decided to write a thank you note to all the volunteers of church. I had a hand cramp for a week. And then I went through and I realized, I think there's only two people I didn't write a thank you note to. So that week I went up and asked them to start doing stuff, and they're like, sure, I'll be glad to help. I'm like, I'm up to like 98% now. Because our motto here at Searchlight Ministries is, welcome to church, here's a toilet brush. Let's get to work. There's people upstairs watching your kids. How important are they? Oh, you have no idea. And can I do what they do? No, I can't. Oh, let me tell you, I tried to do it with kids. Tried to lead a group of Cub Scouts to tell them about God. They crucified me. Oh, it was a slaughter fest, right? Mike, yeah. There's certain things that I can do. Now, how many of you can get up here and talk? Most of you would be like, I would much rather have 1,000 paper cuts on my tongue and suck on a lemon. Yeah, there's no way. But it doesn't bother me. I have no problem getting up here and talking, as you can probably tell. But there's other things I can't do, but there's other things that you do that I can do. Which means I need you, and you need me, and we all need to work together, because that's what Searchlight Ministries is about. And when we get to heaven, God is not going to say, what, all you did was hang out with babies in the nursery? What kind of loser, pathetic person are you? What, all you did was bake some communion bread? Oh, you are horrible. Oh, but Mark over here. Mark, he preaches every week, and he's obviously so important. I'm going to give him a bigger house than all of you in heaven. And the answer is no, because God honors all parts equally, as well as church does too. If you don't have a place to fit in, and you've been thinking to yourself, I need a volunteer, I'll show you where. That's how we got Dave. I preached one of these sermons. Carol tells me this. I preached one of the sermons. You got to get involved. And so that week he goes back and he says, I think I need to get involved. I think I'll do the sound. And that was 9 years ago. 9 years ago, and he's still doing the sound. He's working right now, so he sucked his son into it. And now he does it. Some of you have been baking communion bread and leading kids and all that stuff. I tell you, I could not do this without you. So thank you. And sometime in the next month or so, I'll be contacting Garrett. We'll get a plan, because I want to say thank you from the bottom of my heart. And that all of you share in the plunder and the spoil that Searchlight has all together. It's incredible. I'll finish this up here. David arrived in Ziklag. He sent some of the plunders to the elders of Israel, who were his friends, saying, here's a present for you from the plunder of the Lord's enemies. I think that might be slightly politically motivated, just my concept, because it does happen. Saul is going to die the next chapter. David will become king, and guess which region of the territory acknowledged him as king first? It would be the south, because they got all the presents, and David protected them the most. And he sent it to those who were in Bethel, Ramoth, and blah, 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 blah. And if you want to pronounce those names, have at it. Verse 31, and in Hebron, and to those in all the other places where David and the men has roamed. And so he shares that plunder and that gift, because he realizes it wasn't his anyway. It was all God's. And that's how it is. Let's pray. Lord God, I pray for stuff, people, faith that maybe we have lost. Maybe some of us have lost courage. Maybe some of us have lost direction. Maybe some of us have lost friends. And I pray, Lord, for a restoration, that you would come in and make everything right. And if we get a chance to see that here on earth, then we praise you. And if not, then we look forward to a time when all will be restored. I pray, Lord, for those that go through dark and desperate times, that we would not be quick to walk by on their side, but instead to ask how things are going and to lend a supporting hand. Lord, I pray for our neighbors and our friends, as maybe they need some help or maybe they need some comfort. And instead of having us so distracted by our own mission, we would stop and see. We never know how you're going to use us throughout the day. And I praise you for this church and for this body, for how amazing it is that we all work and we all contribute. And thank you for such a healthy body. And I pray for everyone that gives in small ways. Maybe there's some people that just simply pray, and they pray their guts out for this church. And it'll be stuff that never even gets seen. I pray for the one gentleman, and he hates it when I acknowledge him, the one guy that every morning, every Sunday morning, he pulls out all the stuff for kids' church. And he never wants me to help because that's what he does. That's his job. Pray for people that bring food and communion bread, for band members, for worshipers. Thank you. Thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.